This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm David Berg. As the number of coronavirus infections and deaths continues to rise in the United States, several states are taking action to prevent infections. We get more from AP's Ed Donahue.
In New York, restaurants, bars, and gyms will have to close by 10 p.m. No private gatherings of more than 10 people. In Indiana,
we are in the midst of a second surge.
Governor Eric Holcomb is bringing back some restrictions that limit crowd sizes and extends a mask mandate.
Unfortunately, too many of us and around the country have let our guards down and either assumed we won't get it, or if we do, so be it.
In Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Mayor Paul Ten Haken said no to a mask mandate.
I believe the small uptick in compliance we will see are not worth the community division that this will create.
Violators would have been fined $50. I'm Ed Donahue.
Temperature checks and asking about symptoms might seem like good ways to screen for COVID-19, but a new study suggests they aren't very effective. AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
It's disappointing news for schools, factories, and prisons, which rely on temperature and symptom screening to detect people infected. The study tested more than 1,800 Marine recruits who were paired with a roommate at the Citadel. They had to wear masks and stay 6 feet apart and had daily virus screenings. Although 16 recruits tested positive, only one had symptoms on arrival. 2 weeks later, 35 tested positive, but only four showed symptoms. The study leader says there were six different clusters of cases, but no indication they were occurring. Another researcher, not involved, says routine testing is needed for younger adults who often show no symptoms. I'm Jackie Quinn.
For more, visit our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. President-elect Joe Biden has chosen his longtime advisor Ron Klain to reprise his role as his chief of staff, installing an aide with decades of experience in the top role in his White House. Klain served as the coordinator to the Ebola response during the 2014 outbreak. In a statement Wednesday night, Biden suggested he chose Klain for the position because his longtime experience in Washington had prepared him for such challenges. Biden's statement said that Klain's deep, varied experience and capacity to work with people all across the political spectrum is what is needed in a chief of staff to help confront the virus outbreak and to bring the country together. Klain will lead a White House likely to be consumed by the response to the coronavirus pandemic, which continues to spread unchecked across the nation, and he'll face the challenge of working with a divided Congress that could include a Republican-led Senate. Republicans are assured of at least 50 seats in the next U.S. Senate. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
Republican Tom Tillis has won re-election to the U.S. Senate in a hard-fought race in North Carolina. Tillis was declared the winner by the Associated Press Wednesday afternoon, with a lead of about 94,400 votes over Democratic challenger Cal Cunningham, and not enough outstanding votes to make up the difference. Cunningham's campaign imploded in the final month as he admitted to a recent extramarital relationship. Wins by Tillis and Alaska incumbent Dan Sullivan earlier Wednesday assure Republicans of at least 50 seats in the Senate. Control of the Senate will ride on the outcomes of two runoffs in Georgia on January 5th. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Pope Francis has pledged to rid the Catholic Church of sexual abuse and offered prayers for victims of former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick one day after the Vatican released a detailed report into his sexual misconduct. AP's Charles de Ledesma has the story.
Francis concluded his weekly general audience, saying the report into the painful case of the former high-ranking American cardinal had been released the previous day. He then said, "I renew my closeness to victims of any abuse and commitment of the church to eradicate this evil." Francis paused silently for nearly a minute, apparently in prayer. The Vatican report blames a host of bishops, cardinals, and popes for downplaying and dismissing mountains of evidence of McCarrick's misconduct. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Stocks were mixed on Wall Street, with the Dow Jones Industrials down, but the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ closing in positive territory. For more on these stories, visit voanews.com. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 12, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ivory Coast President Ouattara meets with May opposition leader Conan Bedie.
This meeting is the first step of the relaxation of the situation, and we are waiting to know what this meeting will lead to.
Disputes threaten Somalia's national elections timeframe. Kenyans want their views included in the Building Bridges Initiative final report. Zimbabwe teachers reject a promised salary increase as far too low. And Angolan police again take on anti-government protesters.
From my house, I could hear gunfires. And then minutes later, I was listening to the radio, and they were telling us that one of the activists, a young fellow, that was killed by a police officer because they were using live ammunition against the demonstrators.
And a coronavirus vaccine shows promise, but there are concerns about its usefulness in developing countries. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara on Wednesday met with opposition leader and former President Henri Konan Bedie. Tensions have been rising since President Ouattara won a controversial third term that the opposition said violated the Constitution. The opposition set up a parallel government called the National Constitutional Council, and the government responded by arresting opposition leaders. President Ouattara said the two leaders decided to make peace. Journalist Felix Boni in Abidjan says Ivorians are also hoping that Wednesday's meeting will be the beginning of the end of the political tensions and violence in the country.
I think that this meeting is the beginning of the relaxation of the situation in Cote d'Ivoire. You know that during these last weeks, we have violence after the election, even before the election and the election day also. And opposition and power was in a critical situation. And this meeting is the first step of the relaxation of the situation. And we are waiting to know what this meeting will lead to.
Felix, the opposition had set up a national transitional council and made certain demands. Does this dialogue between President Ouattara and Mr. Bedie mean that the opposition will now abandon the idea of setting up their own government?
Yes, I think the opposition will have to abandon some position like the creation of the National Transition Council, for instance, and the creation of the government. I think they will abandon some of the position. But for the time being, President Bedie has tell his comrade to have a meeting on Friday in order to agree on all the concerns before meeting Mr. Ouattara again. You know, this opposition was out of strategy, and it is very important for them to have dialogue with the power, which is also in a difficult situation faced to the opposition and the violence in the country.
So, Felix, we know that Mr. Bedie is now the leader of the opposition platform. Does he speak for all the opposition parties, including the party of former President Laurent Gbagbo? In other words, I'm trying to say, how united is the opposition?
I think this opposition still be united because when Mr. Bedie met Mr. Ouattara, he said that he met Mr. Ouattara on behalf of the opposition platform. So he did not go there as the president of his own party, but he went there as the spokesman of all the platform of the opposition. So the opposition still be united, and they have the same concern. And on Friday, when they will meet, I think they will present to Mr. Ouattara the same concern about the situation.
What can you tell us about violence following the election? Has it gone down?
For the moment, there are not many violences in the country, but these three last days, we noticed critical violence in the center of the country, in the area called Mbato. Mbato is in the areas of Mr. Afingesan's locality. And we noticed that there has been a lot of person wounded and murdered in this area. And we hope that it is with the hand of these violences after the meeting between Mr. Ouattara and Bedie.
Felix, thank you very much again for speaking with us. We do appreciate it very much.
Thank you, my friend.
That was journalist Felix Bowani speaking with us from the Ivorian capital, Abidjan. The International Crisis Group says Somalia is falling behind schedule on conducting parliamentary and presidential elections. The Brussels-based research organization says the process is threatened by disagreements and the lack of a mechanism to handle disputed election results. The group is calling for term extensions to avoid a political conflict. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
The Somali government's plan to hold elections by February is facing resistance from opposition groups, displeased with the choices to represent their clans in the first round of voting. Somalia holds indirect elections in which clans choose members of parliament through special elections. Then the 275 lawmakers and 59 senators elect the president. Omar Mahmoud, a Somali analyst for the International Crisis Group, says the disagreement could affect the electoral process.
I think it'll be a little difficult with the timelines in place. So we've already seen some slippage around that. The Federal Electoral Commission, the naming of that really happened a few weeks behind schedule. The state electoral commissions are still pending. And we also see some disputes over the names that are being put forth here. And so the political oppositions come out.
Another problem is the composition of proposed committees to handle electoral disputes. The central government and Somalia's federal member states agreed to appoint the committees together, but a statement issued Tuesday by 12 presidential candidates said the list was full of members from the intelligence service and some civil servants. In a Facebook post, Somali Deputy Prime Minister Mahdi Guleid said the statement rejecting the government appointees was surprising, and he sees the presidential candidates as lacking confidence and hopeless. Abdi Ali Hassan, a member of the current Somali parliament, blames the electoral model agreed by leaders as an obstacle to the country's progress. He says the indirect election is full of corruption, blame games and nepotism, and terror groups may have a say in it. He says, I always supported the one-person, one-vote plan, and the reason I was against the indirect vote, I've already explained. Those who wanted the indirect vote carried the day in support of democracy. We agreed to that idea. I won't support another indirect vote. Mahmoud says if the deadline cannot be met, then Somali leaders should agree on an extension for a few months to their terms in office to allow more time to conduct a credible election.
At the end of the day, that's an option we throw out there, but it absolutely must be consensus-based. And the only way you're going to get to a consensus-based decision there is, one, if it's very limited in terms of duration, and two, it's very focused. So very focused on some of the technical details and making sure some of that work gets done. So I think there's room for, you know, the international community or others to maybe explore the idea. But ultimately, it comes down to the role to the Somali stakeholders themselves.
The Brussels-based group notes Somali politicians are open to a slight adjustment to the election time frame. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
Kenyans are making their views known about the Building Bridges Initiative report, which was launched to the public last month. The BBI, as it is called, seeks to amend 58 articles of the Constitution, including the executive, legislature, and the judiciary structures. Some segments of the country are demanding amendments to key aspects of the document that specifically impact their groups. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, one of the key principles of the BBI report says it is unlikely that there will be any new changes.
The Pastoralist Parliament Group has called on the Building Bridges Initiative steering campaign team to listen to their views before the final report is tabled for referendum. Speaking on behalf of the Pastoralist Group, Ibrahim Ali Roba, the governor for Mandera County, outlines a number of issues that he says his group wants to be included in the final BBI report.
The following are our irreducible minimums for us to support the BBI as pastoralists in this country. On the proposed additional 70 seats, we demand a distribution that guarantees each of the 47 counties to at least get one constituency slot. On the issue of community land protection, we demand that protection of land use policies for pastoralist land for grazing and agriculture. On the issue of discrimination, we propose registration of persons and issuance of national identity card and other crucial documents to make sure all pastoralists of age are registered and can access services as any other citizen without discriminatory vetting.
persons living with disability have demanded that their views be incorporated in the document. The leader of the group, nominated Senator Isaac Mwaura, outlined several demands, including increasing the representation in the executive and in parliament before they can support the report.
That we demand that 18 out of the 70 party list slots in the National Assembly, 9 men and 9 women, to be reserved for persons with disabilities. At least we have one cabinet minister, 2 deputy ministers, 3 principal secretaries to serve in the government. That at least one CEC member of each county be a person with disability to ensure that we also represented at the executive level of the county government. And the H, that the composition of all constitutional commissions, at least one commissioner be a person with disability. Finally, we wish to state that if this is not considered, we shall mobilize our 5 million persons with disabilities and their families and allies to reject the BBI report.
The Evangelical Churches of Kenya also want contentious issues previously raised by the church in the 2010 constitution included in the BBI report before it is subjected to a referendum, including the controversial abortion clause. Bishop Kefa Oma is the chairman of the Kenya Council of Church Alliances and Ministries.
During the 2010 referendum, the church raised pertinent issues by highlighting some contentious provisions in the constitution on issues on legalization of abortion and homosexuality, threat to religious freedom, etc., which we still express the need to be addressed. We recommend that a national delegates conference be convened so that the outstanding issues are discussed and consensus achieved so that BBI process get us more united and a cohesive country. We are concerned about the speed at which some of our political leaders want this process completed.
However, opposition leader Raila Odinga, who is also one of the principals of the BBI report, said on Tuesday that it is unlikely that there will be any new changes to the BBI report. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 12. A U.S.-based rights group, Friends of Angola, is calling on the Angolan government and international community to investigate what it says are killings and aggression against peaceful protesters. Florindo Chivuku, executive director of Friends of Angola, says Angola's constitution guarantees citizens the right to peacefully demonstrate. But he says Angolans who took to the streets again on Wednesday in yet another protest against unemployment, high cost of living, and in support of the holding of municipal elections were met by aggression by Angolan security forces.
I know the folks that organized the protest. I've met with them because that's what we do. We work with civil society. They have shown us the letter that sent to the government reporting they intend to have a peaceful protest in Luanda. So to my surprise, one of my colleagues called me and said that one of the activists, Laurinda Gouveia, she's a well-known activist, she was tortured and she was unconscious. So I got in the computer and I started making some calls. Then that's when I saw another fellow. His name is Nito Alves, who also was tortured as well and was laying down on the ground. There was pictures showing. And when I made the calls to talk to folks to find out what's going on, and they told me that he was unconscious as well. A few minutes later, I turned on the radio online, a local radio. It's called Radio Despertar, to listen to the protest. It was the only channel that was broadcasting the protest live. The national TV, TPA, One, Two, and Zimbo, none of them were reporting what was going on in the streets. And then from my house, I could hear gunfires. And then minutes later, I was listening to the radio, and they were telling us that one of the activists, a young fellow, that was killed by a police officer because they were using live ammunition against the demonstrators.
You said that the Angolan authorities carried out or killing and aggression against unarmed protesters on Wednesday. How do you know this?
First of all, because I'm here, I'm in Angola, although I live in the U.S., but I'm currently located in Angola. Second, because like I stated, we work for civil society. I work for Friends of Angola. I'm the executive director. That's what we do. So we have a lot of people on the ground. people from civil society who work with us. So I could make calls, they could confirm. But like I said a few minutes ago, I could hear the gunfires from my apartment where I'm staying. And then a few minutes later, the radio confirmed that there's a young activist. His name is Lukombo. I'm not quite sure about his first name, but his last name is Lukombo. He was killed. And minutes later, there were videos confirmed as well that he was killed.
Our understanding is that the authorities have banned Wednesday's protest. If that is the case, can we say that the protest was illegal?
No, you cannot say that's illegal because there's no legal ground to call a constitutional right as illegal. And it was challenged in the previous protest as well, this argument that the government somehow could prohibit the protest. They can't. It's a constitutional right. Unless the government would constitute a state of emergency, then maybe they could put that on a hold. But as of now, there's no legal ground to call this protest illegal.
You have called on the Angolan government and international community to open an independent investigation. Do you have hope that this will happen?
I don't have hope that the Angolan government will investigate this because it's clearly there's no will to do so. Now, my hope is that the international community will open an investigation. And let's just remind everyone, in addition to the constitution, the Angolan government signed on the Declaration of Human Rights, the African Charter on Human Rights and People's Rights.
Florindo Chivokut is the executive director of Friends of Angola. You are speaking with us from the Angolan capital, Luanda. Zimbabwe teachers' unions have rejected a more than 100% salary increase awarded to them as part of the government's efforts to reopen schools. The teachers say a promised new salary of about $180 per month is still below the poverty line of about $540. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, students are spending time alone in classrooms as teachers do informal jobs.
This is the sound of students at a government primary school in Harare playing outside their classrooms without supervision. Teachers have refused to implement Zimbabwe's reopening of schools after closing in March due to the coronavirus. On Tuesday, the government announced a new monthly salary of about $180 for teachers. Takawa Fira Joe, president of the Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, said it was a high-sounding nothing which was unilaterally awarded to them.
What workers want is a holistic salary increase that resonates with the salaries they were earning in 2018, salaries that are around $520 to $550. So as of now, the salaries would not allow teachers to educate their own children and to ensure that they do all their responsibilities to their families. So the teachers remain incapacitated.
Incapacitated is a euphemism for Zimbabwe's teachers saying their salary is not enough for their basic needs. Amon Murwira is Zimbabwe's Minister of Higher Education. He says the new salary is what the government can afford and hopes teachers return to work soon.
Government is very sensitive to the plight of the teachers, but it's sensitive to the plight of all Zimbabweans for that matter, including the students. At the current moment, teachers have been given a 10% risk allowance, and we expect that these gestures that government is doing is showing sincerity towards the improvement of the lives of its employees, and we also expect that there is a positive response in terms of responsibility because these are our children and we can never use them as pawns in a game of chess.
33-year-old Mnyaradzi Masiwa is a high school science teacher and a member of Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe. He says he makes more money selling brooms in the streets than teaching.
I cannot afford to have food at the table, food that lasts for 1 month. So this is just an insult to the teaching fraternity. We are still appealing to the government to take this issue with the urgency it deserves. Right now, not tomorrow. If we have got the government of the people in Zimbabwe, surely at this juncture, at this moment, they must take action.
Besides a salary of at least $500 per month, the teachers want sufficient personal protective equipment or PPE like masks, face shields, and hand sanitizer to protect themselves against the coronavirus. The government says it has procured $6 million worth of such equipment for schools. The government has also threatened to replace defiant teachers, but so far nothing has enticed the teachers to go back to leading classes. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
A coronavirus vaccine has proved 90% effective in trials, according to developers Pfizer and BioNTech. But as Henry Ritual reports, there are concerns about the ability of developing countries to deploy vaccines requiring specialized handling.
The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine trial is still in its early stages, but scientists say results so far from 44,000 volunteers show the virus can be beaten. The vaccine is based on new so-called mRNA technology and is yet to be approved by regulators. Even if it's fast-tracked, there are other challenges.
There are big manufacturing challenges. There are logistics challenges. This vaccine needs to be stored at minus 80 degrees Celsius.
That's more feasible in richer nations. But in poorer countries, rolling out a vaccination program won't be easy. At this clinic in Burkina Faso, the fridge regularly breaks down, forcing staff to throw away the medicines inside. The United Nations says health systems that serve two-thirds of the world's population don't have adequate refrigeration facilities.
So if today we had to vaccinate against the coronavirus, for example, we would need a lot more refrigerators to keep the vaccines. We don't have these fridges.
Then there's the problem of power.
The hot climate means that the cooling devices are more important and have to work harder. It's a lack of electricity. It's developing economy. So if you look in a number of these markets, you can find areas where countries where perhaps 30, 40% of the health centres don't have access to electricity.
The United Nations Children's Fund spent $85 million in 2019 on refrigeration equipment, mostly solar-powered refrigerators in Africa and Asia. It's also stockpiling syringes and developing cold chain storage and transportation ahead of any vaccine approval. But in many countries, scientists say the health infrastructure simply doesn't exist to roll out any rapid coronavirus inoculation program. An added challenge is getting people to clinics or visiting them in the community and persuading them the vaccine is safe. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine requires two doses per person. Then there's the danger of vaccine nationalism, the concern that rich countries buy up all the vaccines for their own populations. Over 150 countries have signed up to a global facility called COVAX to try to ensure equitable distribution.
With the goal being to help produce 2 billion doses of various COVID vaccines that could be distributed to all of these countries around the world by the end of 2021.
Scientists say other coronavirus vaccines currently in trials also could prove effective, boosting hopes of large-scale inoculation programs. But they warn until such programs are rolled out, it's vital that governments and individuals continue to try to suppress the spread of the virus as infection rates continue to soar. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And that's it for this Thursday, November 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butt in Washington saying, have a great day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.